Today we're going to pick right up where we left off on lecture on Monday, and we're going to be building to a discussion of intermolecular forces. So at the very end of lecture last time, we got to electronegativity, which I won't write the definition down again, but I'll at least say it out loud. Electronegativity is the ability, the tendency of an atom to pull electron density towards itself when that atom is part of a bond. And so to repeat the example I did in class, I want to talk about water again. And right now, I'm focusing just on what makes a bond polar. So, everyone, those of you with questions of the quiz, I'm ignoring them for now, but I will get to them after class, because everything's going to be answered later anyways. So rather than send individual messages to everyone, you'll all get class announcements. So I'm not trying to be rude. It's just since lecture's going, everybody will get quiz information later. All right. So I was talking about bond polarity the other day. Oxygen is a much more electronegative atom than hydrogen is. And so that means oxygen is going to pull electron density towards itself. And that means that hydrogen is going to be left with a lack of electron density. And so that difference in charge that's separated across space is something called a dipole. And you might recall that there is an alternate way to graphically represent that dipole. And that's to use an arrow that's got a plus sign at one end. The arrow shows which way electron density is being drawn, and then the plus shows, in contrast, which side has had the electron density pulled away from it. And so a bond, and I'm going to highlight the word bond. A bond is polar. When there is a difference in the electronegativities of the atoms in the bond. If we're talking about individual bonds, then molecular shape has no impact on bond polarity. Okay, there may be exceptions, and that might be a more complicated statement, but for first time learning through the subject, all we have to look at is whether one atom is more electronegative than the other, and that's going to tell us if a bond is polar or not. But molecular polarity, or I'll say it this way, a molecule is polar. And again, the highlighting. When there is asymmetry in the molecular shape. Okay, what do I mean by that? Well, let's say that we have a molecule like carbon dioxide. If you write out a Lewis dot structure for carbon dioxide, it's pretty simple. The best representation is for carbon to have two double-bonded oxygens, each of the oxygens with lone pairs. Now, based off this Lewis dot structure, what's going to be the shape?
Linear.
And therefore, what's going to be the angle between the bonds?
180.
So that means that we do have dipoles in the bonds, because the carbon-oxygen double bond is going to be polarized. So one bond will point one direction, but the other bond will point in the equal and opposite direction, which means the two dipoles cancel each other out. That's why carbon dioxide is nonpolar, which, to jump to the end of the story, that's why it's a gas at room temperature. So in carbon dioxide, the bond dipoles are equal in magnitude but opposite in direction. Therefore, they cancel each other out. So the molecule is nonpolar. Now, those of you who speak math, the vector sum is zero. Same thing. Now, what if you have something like this? Hydrogen cyanide. Well, you have an extreme toxin, but that's a side story. Let's write out that Lewis dot structure. What is its molecular shape? Linear. Which, again, means that there's a 180 degree angle. Now, I don't know without looking it up. I should, and I'm going to guess.
I have a question.
Oh, yes. I have an answer.
Those green arrows, are they dipoles?
Yes, they are. Yes, those are the dipoles. Okay, so I'm guessing that the carbon-nitrogen bond is more polarized than the carbon-hydrogen bond is. So if I want to try to show vector magnitude, I'm going to use a smaller arrow for the left-hand one and a bigger arrow for the right-hand one. So in hydrogen cyanide,
is the length related to the magnitude? Like, if it's shorter, then it's a less strong. Like, you draw it right there.
Bond strength is related to length. Bond polarity is not necessarily.
Okay.
Usually, as you go from single to double to triple, the bonds get tighter, shorter, and more total energy to break the entire set of bonds. Okay, so in hydrogen cyanide, the bond dipoles point opposite directions. But they're not equal in magnitude. So they do not cancel. Therefore, the molecule is polar. So one form of asymmetry. The whole point of this example is what I said earlier. A molecule is polar when there's asymmetry in the molecular shape. That could be in the shape itself, which we'll get to in a moment, meaning the Vesper shape. But it also could mean the dipole. So maybe a better way to say it, a molecule is polar when there is asymmetry in the bond dipoles. That's the even better way to say it. There we go. Will you ask us to draw the arrows with the dipole length proportional to the electronegativity? Well, since everything's open, no, why not? Okay, take your screenshots. Questions on the first page.
So for the hydrogen cyanide H straw, that means that the nitrogen has more strength than the H side, the hydrogen side?
Oh my goodness. And I actually wrote this wrong. Holy smokes. Wow. I guess I got to stop teaching organic chemistry now. This is a bad example, folks. I'm going to have to come up with a new example. Hold on. Yikes. Because they actually point the same direction. Because carbon is more electronegative than hydrogen is. Yeah. And nitrogen is more electronegative than carbon is. So the idea was great, you know, having equal direct or opposite directions, but not equal. I mean, it was a great idea, wasn't it? If only it was true. Wait. So let's change the story to make it correct. And maybe if I can think fast enough while I'm talking, I'll come up with another example. Oh, hell. I know the example, but let me fill it in with the right answer. Or, wait, since I wrote this out already, through the magic of technology, there we go. I used my think on my feet skills. That's what you get a few years after teaching. And voila, which is French for see here. This is going to have the same structure to it. It's just we have a sulfur oxygen versus sulfur, a carbon sulfur versus a carbon oxygen bond. And let me change this now. Let me erase this. So then in this molecule, the bond dipoles point in opposite directions, which they absolutely do. Sulfur is more electronegative than carbon, but not as the sulfur is not as electronegative as the oxygen. So that means now the picture is correct. The bond dipoles point in opposite directions, but they're not equal in magnitude, so they do not cancel. So this molecule is polar. Now, if you'll take your updated screenshots, let me write that story for HCN, because it is another good example, now that I got my act straight. Okay, so let me write HCN. So, again, the bond dipoles point the same directions. So, although HCN is linear, both bond dipoles point in the same direction. So the molecule is polar. Now, here's a generalization. If all atoms are attached, if all atoms attach to the central atom, are the same. certain molecular shapes are automatically polar, and certain shapes are automatically nonpolar. All shapes without lone pairs are nonpolar. And that includes linear, trigonal planar, tetrahedral, trigonal bipyramidal, and octahedral. Now, these, because the question came up the other day, and this is why we're still doing review, because if you're having these kinds of questions, we need to make sure it's resolved. Because if I ask if this molecule is polar or not, you need to be able to answer that for the stuff we're supposed to be learning this quarter. So, you might recall from 1A that there's what's known as molecular geometry and electron pair geometry. And these shapes I've mentioned here all happen to be electron pair geometries. So let me define what that means. Electron pair geometry ignores the differences between bonding pairs and lone pairs of electrons. And the reason I point this out is that means that each of these is a family of related shapes. So, for example, within tetrahedral, we have two other shapes that are nearly identical in terms of angle. They're just a couple of degrees off from each other. And those would be trigonal bipyramidal and bent. But because of those lone pairs, those shapes will never be totally symmetric. Only the symmetric shapes are automatically nonpolar. And those are the five shapes I've listed here. So only one shape with lone pairs, no, two shapes. Only two shapes with lone pairs are nonpolar. One of them is square planar, and that happens in a compound like platinum tetrachloride. So in that case, the two lone pairs are directly opposite of each other, and so they do cancel out. So again, this is square planar. And the other example is, wow, I actually remembered it without looking. I earned my geek badge today. The I3 minus ion is something that came up in one of your Chem 1A labs. And if you did calculate formal charge, you'd figure out it is the middle iodine. that has the negative charge on it. Because we have 2, 4, 6 electrons in lone pairs, and then 2 electrons from bonds that would count towards that iodine. But those 3 lone pairs all form a kind of triangle that balance each other, so the lone pairs cancel. This is actually another linear shape. So all other shapes with lone pairs are polar. In fact, unless there's some absolutely bizarre coincidence that I just don't happen to know because I don't know everything in chemistry, they're always going to be polar. This includes bent, trigonal pyramidal. There's 2 bent shapes, by the way, if you really remember your Vesper. So bent, trigonal pyramidal, T-shape, seesaw, and square pyramidal. Any questions? Oh, yes, that's a badly drawn T. That is platinum. Let me try again. You had one job, Dr. Gray. Okay, questions before moving on. So, Section 1, you heard some of this discussion the other day, but what happened in lab in Section 2 is I guess we ran behind somehow. So I'm going to repeat a little bit of discussion you've already heard to make this officially a lecture topic. And so I'm going to be posting that from these notes here. Because we're learning about intermolecular forces. So even though not everything's a molecule, I'm going to give up worrying about the distinction and we'll all just get over it too. That, okay, lots of stuff comes as molecules, and in the cases where they're not, well, we'll just worry about it. So intermolecular forces, these are attractive electrostatic forces that draw molecules together. Electrostatic forces, what does that mean in English? Opposite charges attract. So, for example, this is the molecule bromomethane. Methane means CH4. Bromo means replace one of the hydrogens with a bromine. It's a liquid at room temperature, which means there's attractive forces between molecules. Why? Well, because the bromine is going to be more electronegative than the carbon is. So there'll be a slight negative charge on the bromine, and there'll be a slight positive charge on the carbon. And so this results in what I call a permanent molecular dipole. It's a dipole that is determined only by the shape of the molecule. or to reword it slightly, a dipole that is generated due to the shape of the molecule. Now, what do these intermolecular forces have anything to do with anything? Here's the example that section one you've already seen now. If we look at water versus methane, not the bromomethane I had up above here, but just plain old methane. One of these is a liquid at room temperature, one of these is gas. And, well, I just hope we all know that it's water, the one that's a liquid at room temperature, at atmospheric pressure. So in this whole discussion here, let us assume that we're talking about 25 degrees Celsius, one atmosphere pressure. Water is a liquid. Methane is a gas. And just in case you didn't know that molecular name before, that's methane. Okay? Now, the molar mass of water is about 18. The molar mass of methane is about 16. So to be understandable, if you made the mistake of thinking, well, okay, water is a more massive molecule, that's why it's a liquid. That can be true sometimes, that sometimes when you get enough bulk in a molecule, it will cause it to be a liquid or solid. But that's not what's causing it in this case. And the comparison I always make is to methane's big brother, ethane. The meth and methane means a single carbon. The F and ethane means two carbons. So yes, in the name methamphetamine, that's what meth means. It's related to a single carbon. Molar mass of ethane is 30. And it is a gas at the 25 degrees Celsius, one atmosphere conditions that I listed up above. So this demonstrates that molar mass alone is not what causes the molecule to be a liquid versus a gas. So just to present the case here, water is a liquid at normal lab conditions. Even though more massive molecules like ethane are gases at the same conditions. And someone's already asking, is there an etymological reason? Wow. Is there an etymological reason for the naming? I tried looking once. I couldn't quite find the answer to that. A lot of organic compounds do have names that come from places, plants, deities, characters in literature. So there's all kinds of names. Where exactly meth, eth, prop, and bute? From methane, ethane, propane, and butane came from, I will try to find that out. The rest of the hydrocarbons, like what's there, the other ones that are just single bonds like that between carbons and have hydrogens and everything else, after four carbons, it's numerical. So it becomes pentane, hexane, heptane, octane. Like you might have heard the term octane before in relationship to gas. So I'll see if I can find out that naming. Is it the permolecular dipole? Yes, someone's anticipating my answer here as to why there's a difference in behavior between these molecules. And let's examine each molecule one by one. Water not only has very polar bonds,
I think the screen is frozen.
Uh-oh. Thank you. Water not only has very polar bonds, it has asymmetry in its structure. Due to its lone pairs. So it is polar, but it is not polar, it is hella polar. Yeah, I said hella. So it is polar and has a large dipole. Large permanent dipole. Bay Area native or acquired vernacular. I have a difficult to place. I have a difficult to place accent because I was originally born in Houston, Texas, y'all, but then moved to the East Coast to Connecticut, and then to New Jersey first, New Jersey, and then to Connecticut. Can't you see I'm walking here? And then to Huntington Beach, California, dude, and then to Bakersfield. And then back to Houston, and actually there was another bounce to Houston between, and then I end up in the Bay Area, but I've studied a variety of languages, and I tend to pick up accents really quickly, so depending on who I'm talking to, actually, my accent tends to kind of shift around, but hell is because I've been living here too many years. So, methane. Or methane, as some people say. You say tomato. I say tomato. So methane has slightly polar bonds. But it is entirely symmetric. So it has no permanent dipole. Go ahead and take your screenshots.
What is the word? I'm having trouble reading it in the sentence. Water is not only has very polar bonds, it has asymmetry in its structure, and I'm having trouble remembering that word.
That's because I also didn't write correct English. Due to its lone pairs. But you know, talk about correct English. I used to joke with other faculty that if I really wanted to terrify my students, that after going back to Texas over the summer, I'd try to absorb the worst accent I could somehow. So when I came back, I'd start talking more like this. And if I was talking about a writing pan, or a frying pan, or a safety pan, it all come out pan like that. But that's a whole nother story. As in, that's a whole nother story. I will desist with the accent now. Can a molecule change from polar to nonpolar due to too many attractions with other molecules? Ah, you've either been reading the book or you're anticipating, because that is what's known as an induced dipole, that's where really this quarter takes over. Well, okay, this discussion about how intermolecular forces can affect phases, that's related to this quarter. But what kinds of intermolecular forces is where we're really going next. So right now we're specifically talking about permanent molecular dipoles because that's directly related to 1A. But what you just asked about there, can one molecule affect another? Yes, and that's what's known as an induced dipole, which is a form of temporary dipole. Don't worry, we're going to get all the dipole types very systematically once we do this groundwork. So, now why does the extent of intermolecular forces matter? So, section one, you saw this graph already, and I'm breaking my promise because I said I'd never draw one of these graphs again, but section two needs to get my main point here. So let me do this. If we have methane, which has very little intermolecular forces, that means it's not going to take much energy in order to evaporate it. So this is the heat of vaporization of methane. And I know we must have seen that symbol somewhere, but this is heat of vaporization. Vaporization. And that is the energy necessary to convert a liquid into a gas. Now, water has a permanent dipole, so it's automatically going to have more attractions, so it's going to have a much higher heat of vaporization. That means the fraction of molecules that have enough energy to evaporate from methane is way larger than water, which again is why methane's a gas at room temperature and water's not. So in order for it to be a permanent dipole, it has to be very polar and asymmetric. Technically, to be a permanent dipole, we don't really worry about how much of a dipole it is. But yes, it has to be asymmetric. And in order for it to really have any kind of effect, yes, it needs to be very polar. So we're actually going to talk about a case of a molecule that has both nonpolar and polar character to it, which makes it act in a very confused way, but it has a very direct biological relevance. So we'll get there once I can get through this graph right here. So the graph is number of molecules on the y-axis, energy per molecule on the x-axis. And so let me tell the story. I kind of whipped right through the explanation. So let me tell it point by point. Because water has a polar asymmetric structure, it has much stronger intermolecular forces. Intermolecular forces, attractions between negatives and positives. If water is very polar, it has a very definite negative and positive. So that's why it has much stronger intermolecular forces. So it takes much more energy for it to be able to evaporate. Okay, color coding here, since I got purple in the graph there, because methane has a nonpolar symmetric structure, it has weak intermolecular forces. You might say, well, how does it have any molecular forces if it doesn't have a dipole? Doesn't have a permanent dipole. It can have these temporary ones that I hinted at earlier. So that's why it's not zero intermolecular forces, it's weak intermolecular forces. So because methane has weak intermolecular forces, it takes much energy, takes much less energy for it to evaporate. So now to bring this graph into the discussion, at room temperature, the fraction of molecules of methane with enough energy to evaporate is much greater, much, much, much greater than the fraction of molecules of water with enough energy to evaporate. This is why water is a liquid at room temperature, while methane is a gas. So I'm seeing here in the chat, because water is polar, the molecules are slightly attracted to each other. This causes them to gather, whereas in methane is nonpolar, so they're, well, I won't say no, little attractions, which is why the molecules are gas. Exactly. And maybe you wrote that even before I put the explanation down, but it's correct. And unfortunately, the IMF has intermolecular forces, right? Yes. Please go back to slide 2. There you go. So we are unfortunately out of time for lecture today. Are there any questions before we end? Okay, so I will post the quiz assignment momentarily. I'll activate it in Canvas. You'll have 24 hours to submit it. Those of you who are part of DSPS, you will get whatever normal multipliers you receive. And so the Canvas assignment, it won't be turned off. It'll still be accessible past the normal deadline. But for everybody else, that means it would otherwise be late. So as the directions are going to say, DSPS is Disability Support Programs and Services. So if students receive academic accommodations for whatever verified medical reason, They are allowed different testing conditions, and part of that may include what's known as extended time. That is a legally set up accommodation. And in fact, to just point it out, I cannot give accommodations unless a student has been formally through this program. So that's why some people will be submitting at different times. Now, in terms of format, there's going to be one page that has all the questions on it. If you wish to write your answers on that page, then you can do so and submit that. If you don't write your answers on that page, whether you print it, PDF, whatever you're doing, if you don't write your answers on that page, you still need to include that page so I can go up and put your scores in the boxes. So like I said, if you use the original and you already write on it, you don't need a separate blank copy. I'll just fill in the boxes on the same page you wrote on. But if you don't use that page, however you end up with your answers, then you need to include that original page. This can be all digital. So the three versions I came up with when I wrote up the quiz is I imagine people would either take the original PDF and edit it themselves. They might take the PDF, have some extra pages, but put them all together. And those extra pages might be ones you write on a tablet, or you might even use a word processor to just type up your answers. Or another option would be that someone prints it out, writes on it, or writes on other pages, and just takes photos of all of the pages and combines them together. Whatever you do, you have to end up with one PDF document that you submit. And that was the whole point of doing that exercise, so you had some practice doing it, because now the clock is going to be ticking. The quiz will be due for everyone under normal circumstances at 12:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. Any last questions before we now end? Waitlisted students, I will email out the quiz so you can practice. I will not grade the quiz unless you get into the course. If you end up in the course after the quiz, I'll figure out what to do then.